Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is February 21st, 2019, and this is episode 126. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review. We just got another iTunes review, thanks to random user who left that. That's our first one in a while. And you can also just get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show, though, by throwing us a couple dollars a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Delinebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, yes, we have to keep talking about the BC legislature and SNC-Lavalin affairs, l'affaires, scandals. But first, we'll kick it off with a discussion of the new BC budget. But as always, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. Let's talk about Carol James's balancing act. We had a pretty boring budget to follow a pretty boring throne speech.
Yes, there really wasn't a huge amount new here. In fact, that's probably why they made a point of re-announcing the MSP cuts like three times in the budget document.
Did you know that's a big middle-class tax cut?
Yes, that was announced last year.
Yeah, there was some new stuff, which we'll get to, but a lot of it is continuations of previous promises. It is another balanced budget, predicting a very minor surplus of $274 million following last year's surplus that was projected to be about the same, but it's now looking to be about $374 million. This is of a budget that's roughly $60 billion, so they match the income and expenses. The one note is, though, there's a contingency of $1.25 billion, so there's really like a $1.5 billion surplus here. The headline, though, that the NDP is super proud of is they've gotten rid of the operating debt, though the province still holds a total debt of $72.5 billion, which is up $4.5 billion from last year. The NDP is playing the careful game of not wanting to look like the tax and spend run us into deficits to pay for big spending promises. So I guess that's their way of staving off the Liberals' criticism. That surplus comes with no significant new tax increases. Nothing at least new over what they brought in before. There is an increase in the carbon tax, but that, again, isn't new.
Yeah, a few people tried to seize on it and say, oh, look, gotcha, there's a bunch of new taxes here. But A, that we have to raise the carbon tax anyway because of the federal mandate, and B, this was announced way back when. So there's no new tax when it comes to the carbon tax.
Despite that, there is some significant new spending. The budget lays out that there's over $1 billion going to healthcare funding. There's almost $1 billion set aside for Clean BC, and there's $1 billion for childcare, part of which was previously announced. But the big new thing that Carol James kept hitting on was this child opportunity benefit to replace the early childhood tax benefit. I don't know how the previous thing worked, but I did read up on this child opportunity benefit. The most important thing you should know is it's not actually taking effect this year. It doesn't come into effect until October of next year.
So. But hey, you can get the good press, and the checks start rolling out at a fairly good time in terms of where the electoral cycle is.
Indeed. I think this program largely mirrors the federal child tax benefits, which is a fairly popular program. I mean, it was started in a form by Stephen Harper and then modified and expanded by Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, it's considered a very successful program, and this would be a fairly significant top-up to it. And it also covers the full age range up to 18 years, so, which is more than a bunch of these childhood tax credits go. Like, the old version just cut off at 6 years, I believe.
Yeah, this is up to $1,600 for families with one child, or if you have three kids and want to max it out, it's $3,400. But once you're making over $25,000 a year as a family, I think it starts to roll back.
Yeah, there's a bunch of clawbacks, and it doesn't scale linearly with each new kid. Took a brief look at the federal program. If you combine the two of them, it's for one child, if you're just at the point where there's no clawbacks at all, it's something like around $670 a month combined. That's a significant transfer.
Yeah, the one limit. I don't know if it's a reasonable argument against it, but the new BC program cuts off for families who earn about $100,000, which is a fair middle class income. But when you have two working parents, you hit that reasonably easy. Like two public sector jobs will probably pay you $100,000. Or if you're an MLA or clerk of the house, it turns out you can get that much easily, but we can come back to that later. That said, focusing on those who need it most is not something most people will complain about. So this is likely to be a pretty popular program.
Yeah, if anything, I think the kind of quote-unquote NDP criticism would be it's too means-tested.
I won't lie. The other big thing that plays right to the NDP base is the platform pledge that they've now fulfilled, which is eliminating interest on provincial student loans. They're doing this for all BC students who have existing loans, which means they have to write down $225 million right away. And then over 3 years, the program of not charging interest on these loans will cost about $318 million, but will save students something like $20 million a year in total. The average student will see a couple $1,000s saved. They still owe interest on the federal portion of their loan, but the idea of the government charging students interest on the loans they get from them has always been a source of contention and griping from student activists, I know. And again, it's one of those things that it's really hard to object to because it's not actually that expensive. $30 million a year, $20, $30 million a year to just make education a little bit more affordable and stop punishing people who graduate.
Yeah, it's really just kind of another version of an education subsidy. Like overall, I don't think the idea of student loans is inherently bad because, you know, it's one of those things you're investing in human capital. Like the payoff is a long-term thing where it has some high upfront expenses. It's kind of what loans are good at in that abstract sense. But, you know, not charging arm and leg for interest is also good. But Ellie, it's not like the provincial government doesn't subsidize universities anyway. So it's really kind of just moving money around that pot in a how we're subsidizing education.
Besides that, there wasn't a ton of exciting news in the budget, though a first rent bank is kind of interesting, but it's a pretty modest investment of $10 million. Basically, the idea is if renters end up in really dire straits, the government will have a pot of money that they can apply for a short-term loan on.
Yeah, I believe this is actually run through like local rent banks, so it's not the province setting one up. It's a, hey, if your community sets one up, here's some money you can access for it.
And hopefully that'll create more of these, because if there's money available, things tend to pop up to spend it. There's also a fulfillment of the promise they talked about at the end of last year, which is to share gaming revenue with First Nations communities. We have numbers to that now. It's 7% of BC gambling money will go to First Nations communities, which equates to about $100 million a year, which is hopefully going to be a good start. I think the thing raising the most raised eyebrows is the predictions for ICBC. So we already know it's going to lose $1 billion this year. But what if I told you they're only going to lose $50 million next year?
I would wonder who's cooking their books.
Someone asked David Eby about this, and he said he's been in this job long enough that he's not 100% confident on anything anymore. And I think even the budget itself flags this as a significant risk. But the government's being optimistic here. They're hoping that the number of reforms being put through will bring ICBC under control very quickly and not just essentially balanced its books within a year, but churning a profit within two. Anything's possible.
Yes, but not very likely.
Yeah, it's something to watch. I have no clue where ICBC is going to go. It's such a, as it's been characterized, dumpster fire.
Yeah, I believe that's the official term of art for it.
But yeah, overall, modest, kind of middle of term NDP type budget. I was saying to someone earlier today, feels like they put enough little trinkets in there to try to keep all of their elements of their base not happy, but at least like quiet. Like there's nothing to be upset about. Like there's $50 more a month for low income disability rates, which is welcomed,
I've seen a lot of this isn't enough.
Yeah.
Overall, this budget isn't all that much different than you'd kind of expect kind of a federal Liberal budget to look like. Like there isn't anything that really stands out as would something that would be incongruent with that. It's a fairly steady as she goes, just a little left of center budget.
Maybe that's a testament to the BC Greens influence on it. Maybe it's just Horgan trying not to rock the boat midterm in hopes that he can maybe dish out a few bigger goodies in the advance of an election and otherwise trying to stay out of the limelight. But personally, I'm a bit disappointed. I would have liked to have seen some more ambition. I've heard a lot of criticism that they're not moving faster on $10 a day childcare, or that it seems to have been forgotten.
Well, speaking of things they've forgotten, the $400 renter's subsidy that was, or renter's rebate. Or,
well, the renter's rebate was never a Weaver favorite, and so that kind of disappeared quickly.
But that has also been brought up as something that's still missing from the NDPs.
Well, but the $10 a day to childcare, I think trying to beat them over the wall for that is a bit missing the mark, because even in the platform, it was a 10-year plan. And it does seem a bit stalled, and that's worrying, but the fact that programs are running and will be analyzed for how effective they are over the next year doesn't mean it's given up on in any sense. I mean, personally, I would love to see it much faster, because I don't think it's that hard to demonstrate that making parents more able to work is good for the economy overall and just good for equality in society. But all right, take your time. Don't shock the system with a giant new social program. But yeah, no money for UBC subway line in here. No money for SkyTrain to Surrey.
No gondola money either.
Unfortunately not. There is money for SkyTrain to Arbutus, but that had already been announced. There's a few minor other transit things, but I don't think anything really major or new was announced.
No, like
in
they
here.
Have the Patello Bridge in there too, that replacement that's currently in the bidding process. Led by SNC-Lavalin, they're one of the shortlists on that, which is fun. Yeah, overall, not a huge amount new infrastructure-wise. There's a little bit in the Clean BC program for like $20 million in new fast charging stations.
I was actually a bit disappointed with the numbers at Clean BC in that I felt like everything was a bit small.
$2,000 to replace heating systems with heat pumps. That's, I actually don't know how much one of those systems costs.
I've heard $10,000 for a medium-sized home. But so $2,000 will help, of course.
Yeah, it takes a fair bit off. And like it's one of those things where on payback, and if you naturally afford a home and be here in Vancouver, you'll probably have enough equity you can borrow in a way that makes that payback worthwhile. There's money in there as well to like redo windows and other stuff like that. So enough that it's probably an inducement to a lot of people who are at the margins on whether or not they would do it.
Yeah, I guess it's each individual program within Clean BC is very modest. You know, it's $10 million here, $25 million there. But once you put them all together, it comes up to that $900 million investment. So I am still hopeful with it, but it does still have to square with the LNG Canada project, and they still have to make up that other 25% of our carbon target.
$900 million seems a little low for what they're trying to achieve. Just the level of decarbonization required is going to take more than a bunch of $6,000 rebates to get electric cars and to switch out some heat pumps.
Especially when natural gas is still significantly cheaper than electricity in this province. And if you want everyone to switch their home heating over to electricity, you need to do some of those big things. Changing angles on this a little bit, what are your thoughts on the BC Liberal reaction, which is that this is an uninspired budget, it's totally forgotten the economy, where's the jobs plan?
I feel like the Liberals are still trying to find their feet on how to go after this government. They make a bunch of attacks, none of them really seem to stick. They got a little traction with the speculation tax, but that even didn't go very far. And overall, they haven't really been able to get some that sticks. Part of it's the NDP's run a fairly modest and cautious government, so there isn't really much to attach them on. And I think that's a valid point they raise, that, yeah, there maybe should be more in here about creating jobs and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's good to have a party that's there to kind of bang the drum on, hey, we need to grow the pie quite a bit, whereas, you know, the NDP more focuses on redistributing it, if you know, simplify things a bit. And, you know, that's good, but like, I don't think it's really what's gonna connect with most people at the moment.
Yeah, it feels when, especially once they got onto where's the jobs, 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 that we're almost relitigating the 2013 election with Christy Clark's, you know, Jobs BC plan.
Well, that was the last successful one they ran.
That was, but then they ran that again in 2017. And people went, but you forgot to fund any services with all the money we've been making as a province. And that's what at least brought the NDP into a tie in 2017.
Yeah, I guess I should be so down on the Liberals' 2017 plan. They did technically get more votes and more seats. So it's a success, more so than any of the other campaigns.
But I think it's going to take more than that for the Liberals to crawl back, especially in light of the ongoing scandals, which some of which are theirs to own. Others are just things that kind of were happening in the background, like we'll get to in a minute. I mean, for the Green part, they're voting for this budget no matter what, because they've promised to. And I don't see any advantage to Weaver bringing down the government right now.
No, it'd be a terrible decision on his part, because they're not likely to be in such an advantageous position holding the balance of power going forward.
Yeah. And so his entire pitch has been, you know, the Green fingerprints are all over this, and talks up the Clean BC parts and a few of the other elements that he's happy to see, which if your government and your governing partner is praising your budget, you're in a pretty good spot. So overall, it's a, you know, a solid like B minus budget. Doesn't upset anyone too much, doesn't please anyone too much, and we probably won't be thinking about it within, you know, a few more days.
Oh, I had to refresh the notes on what was it. I read the thing a few days ago. Like, it's a fairly, I guess, uninspired, to borrow Andrew Wilkinson's phrase on it. But like, there's some decent stuff in there, but yeah, nothing earth-shaking, and it's very much the epitome of a state-of-the-course budget. Moving on to segment two, Pletus Strikes Back. We talked last week about the responses that the clerk and the sergeant-at-arms had filed, and today, the Legislative Assembly Management Committee, that committee that up until a few months ago, nobody knew, basically knew existed or paid any attention to if you didn't actually work in the legislature, they voted today to release officially the responses that got leaked to the Vancouver Sun and Darryl Pletus's response to those responses.
We do not yet have the clerk and sergeant-at-arms reply to the speaker's report responding to the clerk and sergeant-at-arms responses to the speaker's report on the clerk and sergeant-at-arms. I'm assuming that will be forthcoming in the next LAMSI meeting. Despite that, Pletus says clearly in his report released today that I have as little desire to engage in a tit-for-tat with the suspended officers as I imagine LAMSI does in an adjudicating one. Nevertheless, the report released today is another piece of golden literature in BC poly history. Pletus has a unique talent, I'll just say, for writing just so directly and calling things bullshit when they are. And that is basically what his report is, going like line by line through James and Lenz's replies to him, going, no, that's bullshit, that's wrong, that's false. There's a section where he's like, here's all the lies they said about things I said.
It's like goes on for 2.5 pages or something.
Yeah. And it's like a nice table too. But calling other people liars is not something one usually does lightly, especially in official reports. But I mean, Pletus at this point isn't known for his subtlety in this investigation. I did have the chance to read this report as I drank a beer just before recording, because it only came out at about like 5:30 today. As I mentioned, he essentially calls James and Lenz big fat liars, and he goes through so many different things. I just want to highlight a few of these elements. One of the big things Pletus gets caught up on, and he really tries to go to show the receipts for this, is a lot of the meetings James and Lenz were having were with the same people. And that doesn't sound that exciting until you realize all over the world, they were meeting the same two British guys in England, in Scotland, in Victoria, and in Washington State, I think. Like, they hosted them twice in BC in 1 year and visited them twice there. So it now almost paints this picture of like jet-setting friends having parties all over the world on the BC legislature's dime. And Pletus also tries to emphasize that this isn't just his word against their word. Pletus has talked to dozens of people, lots of different witnesses, and has the receipts to back things up. So, for example, he goes into these Apple devices and quotes one staff member whose comment is amazing. I have to read these all in full because they're just good. This is a former staffer of the BC legislature. He says, Craig and Gary decided they wanted an iPhone, and the legislative comptroller said no, and computer services said, no, we don't support that. You have the BlackBerry, and that's what you get. So they created a special project and just started buying them outright on their credit cards. When it first started, it was just Craig and Gary, and then it became Craig and Gary and Randy. I don't know who Randy
is. Who is Randy?
Who is Randy? And by the time I was fired, almost everybody had both an iPhone and an iPad. I was supporting all of them, setting them up, teaching them how to use them. They were taking them all over the world, racking up these huge roaming charges, watching movies on these things because they refused to use Wi-Fi because it was too slow. So at one point, we had a bill for one of Craig's trips that was thousands of dollars and had to try to dispute it with Rogers.
Wow.
And we all know roaming charges are terrible for Canadians, but Legislative Assembly officials can use Wi-Fi to watch movies on their questionably, let's say, purchased Apple devices.
I just want to know what the special project got called. Did they come up with some fancy code name for it?
I don't know. A bunch of the other things that Plekis says, we basically touched on last week when it comes to the gift shops and the Bose headphones. But again, I just have to read Plekis verbatim here. Mr. James appears to suggest that he was purchasing items in England for future sales in British Columbia's Legislative Assembly gift shop. Even if that or one of the other justifications given were true, why are the taxpayers of British Columbia paying the high salaries of these senior executives to go shopping all over the world for small gifts? Staff at the Legislative Assembly purchase protocol gifts directly in a way that is transparent and accountable. Whomever manages the BC Legislature's gift shop can no doubt look at the UK Houses of Parliament detailed online gift shop and determine if there are product lines that they feel are suitable to introduce in British Columbia. And he goes on to just ask, who received the mustard, the quotable Churchill book, the wedding memorabilia, the satirical books about Brexit, and where's the Winter King fantasy novel? These are legitimate questions, Scott. We talked last week about the Bose headphones, and I think we both talked about this idea that if it was a legitimate medical purchase, there should have been a process for that. Plekis talks about that, but Plekis is smarter. He goes on the internet and he looks this up and he says, while noise-canceling headphones may address sound issues, I am unaware of them being effective for cabin pressure as they don't create any kind of seal on the ear that would alleviate pressure. In fact, an internet search,
always a reliable source of information,
offers a great many articles in which people complain that noise-canceling headphones cause ear pain. He also points out that James had previously bought Bose noise-canceling headphones in 2011, and 10 years for headphones seems like a reasonable life.
It's where most of mine last.
Except, well, I mean, these are fancy headphones. Except you don't get to bill your headphones to work.
I'm no, assuming. I don't.
Maybe you should try. Do not. My favorite part, though, has to be, again, the wood splitter and trailer, which we revisit once more, this time with photographic evidence. So we'll recall last week in James's report, he talks about what an inconvenience it was to store these items at his personal property, which was a condominium, essentially, a strata.
Not... strata, he called. He didn't say condominium, and that's important, because it is not a condominium. It is a strata-titled property, but it is very much a house with a yard and a place to store a trailer and wood chipper.
Plekis writes, his property may technically be strata-titled development, but is not a condominium. Instead, it is a 3,600-square-foot freestanding house on a 10,500-square-foot lot with trees behind the house.
So there's a few square feet they can find there to put a wood splitter, you know, if you've really worked at it.
And even better is Mr. James writes that he was frustrated storing the trailer at his property, arranged to have it stored in an RV facility. I note, however, that in front of Mr. James' house is a recently constructed paved pad, which he had been storing the legislature's trailer on until he apparently returned it. And then he includes two photos. One is from Google Maps in
2014.
And then beside it is a photo taken from the passenger seat of a car, and you can see the side mirror of the car and a picture of this trailer sitting on a freshly paved pad, which was taken in October 2018. I don't know who took the photo, but in my mind, I'm picturing Plekis and Mullen driving around Victoria, snapping photos like spies out of the side of their car.
I have them in my head pictured dressed as the Blues Brothers for some reason while doing this.
Dark sunglasses, full suits and hats.
Exactly.
Now, what's not seen is the wood splitter, and Plekis says, I don't know where it was. He writes, though, Mr. Mullen viewed it after it was removed, and he advised me that it showed obvious signs of use. So someone was using the wood splitter, according to Mr. Mullen.
Yeah, actually, if you do look at the old pictures, it's of the wood splitter off in that corner of the legislative grounds that have been making their rounds on the internet. Yeah, it very clearly has been used. Like the
maybe
part where the paint's missing, I think. Like, there is no doubt that wood was split. Although, interestingly, I did see earlier today someone reported that a branch had fallen in the legislative grounds sometime within the last month, and a wood splitter was not used for that.
Oh, no. How will they burn it and keep themselves warm during the earthquake? if we'll recall, the defense James also put up was that this purchase was approved by a committee that oversaw spending on these disaster items. What he didn't mention was that Mr. Lenz and James actually sat on that committee that approved the spending. So Plekis throws some shade on this, saying it's not really an answer to say, yeah, a committee approved it, without saying I was part of that committee. And also, when staff sit on a committee and say, I need money for this, people generally go, yeah, you seem to know what you're doing. So maybe James has an excuse for why he paved a pad on his home property.
I suppose we should just be happy at this point. That pad wasn't built to the legislature.
We don't know that yet.
Actually, that is true. There's still some things to be released.
We legit don't know that yet. There was a couple more pieces I wanted to pull out of there. Plekis talks about, in his original report, these weird conversations with Gary Lenz, where Lenz is trying to, like, get Craig James fired. Plekis points out Lenz doesn't make any effort to really respond to those, other than say they're not really relevant. And Plekis adds in this new report, quote, in various instances, I first became aware of alleged misconduct by Mr. James because Mr. Lenz himself told me about it. In response, Mr. Lenz does not deny these conversations, but says he has not had the time and does not, quote, see the purpose in, quote, dealing with my detailed recollections of conversations, calling them hearsay. And Plekis points out, me saying we had a conversation is not hearsay. The subject of the conversation might be, but I can say we talked yesterday, especially if what we were talking about was firing the other guy because he's corrupt. It's bizarre. And finally, there's a section on the truckloads of alcohol where Plekis did try to go and track down the receipts for this story that James put forward, that it was sort of expensed appropriately. But Plekis also points out, why is the clerk spending, like, one of the senior most officials in the legislature spending his time dealing with this anyway?
Yeah,
it's all bizarre.
Yeah, this is the famous alleged truckload of alcohol that was taken from the legislative grounds to the former speaker's residence
in Penticton.
And it turns out that while there may have been some compensation for that truckload of alcohol taken, it was much, much less than the value of the alcohol. So about $370 were given to the legislature for this alcohol, and the value of it's alleged to be more in the order of $10,000?
I think it was $8,000 in the original report. It's not mentioned in this one.
Point is, they probably took a fairly significant loss on this. And not only that, the clerk spent his time on the clock driving it out to Penticton himself for some reason.
There was also apparently a chamber desk and chair given away in this exchange, which were valued around $10,000. And those are not really accounted for in anyone's account since, and who knows what happened there. We don't know.
And then the other item in here is, of course, the luggage, where, as we discussed last time, the luggage set that was alleged to have been purchased by Craig James in, I think it was Hong Kong, and cost something like $1,000. This was to be used for, you know, emergencies as a loaner set if MLAs wanted to travel, but why buy it in Hong Kong? Why buy this very expensive stuff? And also, if there is such a program, how come none of the MLAs that the Speaker Plekis spoke to knew that there was luggage available to be borrowed?
He raises valid questions that we also raised last week. I think the strongest point Plekis makes is, after reading the first set of Plekis's original report and the set of replies, kind of felt like a he said, they said. But when you start reading between the lines and seeing what's missing, Plekis has set out a lot more evidence in my mind. And he has set out a stronger case with receipts. Now, James and Lenz don't have access to receipts because they are on suspension and not allowed on legislature grounds, but there are still holes in their accounts. And the best case scenario, I think Plekis even puts this out at the end, is the most charitable interpretation is they really did and do consider all these activities proper and necessary business expenses. But even if that's true, the approach being taken on all of this spending doesn't pass the sniff test. And it doesn't seem like something that I think in Plekis's mind or mind quote, the vast majority of ordinary British Columbians would find reasonable.
Yeah, exactly. There's absolutely no reason the highest paid person probably at the legislature is, or maybe the premier makes more, one of the highest paid people at the legislature is spending his time doing gift store shopping or all of these other activities or being a personal alcohol delivery person. And that even if they were all legitimate, that how they went about this indicates that there needs to be some very significant reforms. And so far, I don't think we've even gotten to the point where there's any indication that most of these are legitimate.
Well, in terms of digging deeper into this, there was a little bit more that happened at LAMC this afternoon. The committee agreed together and all three House leaders came together and made a combined statement saying a retired judge will be hired to investigate whether any misconduct has occurred. Now, this investigation is in addition to the ongoing investigation that's been launched by the Auditor General's office and a workplace review that's happened. Those were both approved at the last LAMC meeting and whatever the RCMP's two special prosecutors are doing. But at this point, Plekis has been told to back off and leave it to people who
just probably
know what they're doing.
Yeah, Plekis has been going at this for over a year now, I believe. And since we found out about this when the clerk and sergeant arms were suddenly suspended back in November, there's been a lot of questions raised about how the whole process unfolded. But now that it is mostly out there, it seems like a pretty good time for the speaker really doesn't have the expertise to do these investigations, nor does Mr. Mullen, who's been helping him out for most of this. And, you know, it's probably good to turn it over to Auditor Generals and the RCMP, although that the RCMP thing happened back in October, I believe. But having Darryl Plekis, who, you know, speaker, not an uncontroversial one either, being less at the front of this will probably be good.
Yeah, and that's one of the things both James and Lenz's lawyers actually asked for as well, is that Plekis be taken off of the lead of this investigation and it be given to someone more independent. And frankly, the speaker has speakery things to do, like tell people not to call each other names in the House or count votes. So he can get back to that. And eventually we will maybe know the truth of what's going on in the legislature itself, or at very least there'll be some reforms and things will be a bit less allegedly corrupt, one can hope. Well, and the other person being asked to get out of the way is Gerald Butts, as we move on to our third segment this week, butting out of the PM's business. As I mentioned, Gerald Butts, Trudeau's principal secretary, has resigned. Scott, who's Gerald Butts for people who have never heard of this man?
So Gerald Butts has been a long time both friend of Justin Trudeau, going back to their university days, and as well as a long-time Liberal insider, both at Queen's Park in Ontario. He was one of Dalton McGuinty's fairly senior people, who was premier back in like 2003 to, I want to say 2011, early 2000s, Ontario Liberal Party person, moved over to the Federal Liberal Party, or I guess redirected most of his energies that way, because he's always been part of it, when Trudeau took the leadership, and generally considered to be one of the main brains behind the operation and a very senior person, pretty much on par with the chief of staff.
Consider him like the Karl Rove to George W. Bush, except
maybe
not
more
evil.
Senior.
Maybe more senior, but not evil. I mean, unless you really hate the Liberals, which some people do.
Like, yeah, this is huge that he's resigned. Not to diminish or say the minister for sports or something, but his resignation is a bigger deal than if a junior cabinet minister resigned.
Indeed. He was always, he and Katie Telford, the other key brain trust with Trudeau, or that like inner circle of best friends who came to Ottawa, came to the prime minister's office and have been running things. But his resignation, he cites in his letter that, you know, these accusations exist and it shouldn't take away from the work of the prime minister, and it's about his reputation and he thinks it's in the best interests of the office for him to step away. But he doesn't admit to anything. He denies that anything wrong has happened. And so he's kind of going, nothing bad happened. I didn't do anything. but maybe I should just go away, which feels like it raises more questions than answers.
Yes, that's not the sort of thing that just happens when people aren't guilty of stuff or improper behavior.
I mean, in politics it does, because someone has to fall on the sword, but...
Yes, but usually if you're falling on the sword, you actually fall on the sword and say, yeah, this is my fault, I'm taking the responsibility and getting out of here. But he doesn't do that. So without taking the responsibility for the situation, it doesn't actually diffuse any of the tension, and it just raises a bunch of questions, like the ones we're asking right now about, well, why is he stepping down if he's adamant that he hasn't done anything wrong?
Indeed. Well, that wasn't the only thing to really hit the news on the SNC-Lavalin affair, which, I mean, this is what...
We're into our, what, a third week of this now, I believe, and you know, it started with the report in the Globe citing anonymous sources that there was pressure against the then Attorney General to basically give SNC-Lavalin a bit of a sweetheart deal on the prosecution for the bribery. And, well, now that Gerald Butts has resigned without admitting that he actually pressured anyone, more news has developed.
Indeed. It's pretty much become acknowledged at this point that Trudeau himself and or people in the Prime Minister's office were talking to Jody Wilson-Raybould, the former Attorney General,
about this case. This is part of the evolving position of the PM on this, because first was there's no communication on this. Then there was a bit of communication, but it wasn't pressure. And we're kind of in the, there was pressure, but it wasn't improper stage.
Yeah, the clearest element to that was one of the testimonies which happened at the Justice Committee this week, where the clerk of the Privy Council office, and this is where it gets really deep into the weeds, but I think one of the senior bureaucrats who's on the...
Basically the senior bureaucrat.
On the nonpartisan side of government, ideally, but still very connected to the Prime Minister. This is Michael Wenick. He speaks to the Justice Committee, and he admits to talking to Jody Wilson-Raybould about the, quote, consequences of prosecuting SNC, namely that there'll be a bunch of job losses in Quebec, it could affect Canadian economy. He probably didn't say liberal fortunes in Quebec, but that was probably a more partisan member who
may
have mentioned that.
That's probably what Jerry Butts said in his conversation with the Attorney General. But I think importantly in this is that the law that got put into place quietly as part of the last omnibus budget bill specifically requires that the prosecution service does not consider the economic impacts when deciding whether or not to offer one of these deals. So I think this raises just other questions on why is this senior bureaucrat pressuring the Attorney General to do something that, by the law, she is not allowed to consider when she makes her assessment?
He claims it wasn't pressure. It was just a conversation. He also switched tactics, I guess, in the committee meeting and talked about what he really wants to focus on, which is all this rising and toxic rhetoric about treason and traitors, which I agree is a problem.
It's a little outside the purview of clerk of the Privy Council office, but
I did enjoy his comment, which was, those are words that lead to assassination. I'm worried somebody's going to get shot this year during the political campaign, which is pretty blunt. Now, I was thinking about this earlier today, and sometimes one of the tactics you use when you don't want to talk about something is to talk about something shiny or throw something else out there to see if that can take the focus off the thing you don't want to be talking about. So if you're like, I don't know, I don't want to talk about this question about whether the Prime Minister's office or myself were pushing pressure on the Attorney General, I want to talk about people getting murdered by far-right extremists during the election. It's not to say it's not a real issue, but it is a communications tactic and PR tactic that people will use to kind of distract from other issues.
It definitely got a lot of attention. So did his very strong opinions about, you know, what a great job this government's doing and how this is a distraction, which raised a lot of eyebrows in that this is, in theory, a nonpartisan position, although past clerks have maybe crossed the line every now and then. But, like, it's definitely came across as more partisan than objective, and, you know, the opposition members of the committee picked up on that a bit too, I think, but definitely the national press was kind of their main takeaway on this. And it's really not a good look. And yeah, it may have changed the subject a bit from, did the Prime Minister inappropriately pressure the Attorney General to drop a prosecution, and just turn it into a, how partisan is the civil service, which is not a great way to change the topic.
Especially when the civil service is generally viewed as, legitimately or not, liberal sympathizers.
Granted, there's occasional reason to think that. I mean, there's this performance. There was the applause that Trudeau got when he was first elected and he walked into the building that housed then Foreign Affairs, since renamed Global Affairs. Like, that's generally not the sort of thing public servants should be doing.
So that's also a bad look for the Prime Minister's office. The other bizarre thing that happened this week is Jody Wilson-Raybould came back and asked to speak to Cabinet. And I don't know if this is something that happens where someone who leaves Cabinet then wants to have a in with the meeting on them. And so no one really knows what she went to ask because it's privileged and confidential. But the government cabinet did debate for 2 hours about whether she should be allowed in. And there are some reports about who was on whose side. All I think I saw was, I think it's Labor Minister Paddy Hadju was batting for Jody Wilson-Raybould. I don't know if that's true. And the only thing that was leaked out was that Jody Wilson-Raybould was not really apologetic about it. She seems proud of what she's done. And I guess maybe she was trying to push the government or cabinet to let her speak, which seems to be the next thing everyone's waiting for. You know, will the government waive its attorney-client privilege with the attorney general and say you can tell your side of the story? Because for now, she's saying she can't.
I'm going to guess no. Like, we're into week three of this by now. The fact that there hasn't been a clear definitive answer on this, Ottawa is not short on lawyers. Like, you should be able to figure this one out by now. And the fact that they haven't basically leads me to believe they're stalling.
The other effort to try to let her speak was this NDP motion in Parliament that called for a full public inquiry into the whole situation and the government to waive its privilege. Obviously, the Liberals defeated this motion with their majority, probably with the Bloc Québécois on side as well. But notably, one Liberal didn't vote for the motion, and that was Jody Wilson-Raybould, who has a clear conflict of interest in the issue. But what was notable is after the motion failed, she stood up and gave a very brief speech.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would ask that the record show that I abstain from voting on that matter. The reason for my abstention is that the matter in part has to do with me personally, and I do not think that is appropriate for me to vote on a matter that has to do with me personally. I have said that I am seeking counsel on this matter of what I can and cannot say. I understand fully that Canadians want to know the truth and want transparency. Privilege and confidentiality are not mine to waive, and I hope that I have the opportunity to speak my truth.
And that speech managed to get a standing ovation from the Conservatives and NDP, which former Liberal cabinet members don't tend to get. She's basically hoping to speak the truth at some point.
But did everyone but the Liberals at this point would like to see? So far, we've only heard one side of the story, and or at least on the record, one side of the story.
And that side has changed multiple times in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, we need to hear the other side. And this isn't going to go away until she gets a chance to speak.
And even then, all of this is leaving me wondering, and I'm hearing more and more podcasts and analysts try to analyze this, and everyone seems to have this, like, growing amount of respect and admiration for Jody Wilson-Raybould and her handling of this controversy, which follows a pretty uninspiring time by most people's account of her time as justice minister.
Yeah, we were pretty down on her for most of her time as justice minister. And when she got taken out of the attorney general role, it didn't raise red flags for either of us because there had been issues with a bunch of the justice legislation that had gone through. But this whole affair, I definitely think, has helped her image. And I believe there's some polling out now on this that says most Canadians believe her, not the Liberals, or not the other Liberals.
The Trudeau.
Yes, not the Prime Minister.
Well, maybe Trudeau steps down and Jody Wilson-Raybould becomes leader of the Liberal Party into the federal election.
I think that's unlikely. This has to get a lot more damaging for Trudeau. It has to get to the point where it looks like he's going to lose badly, and that the risk of running a leadership race 9 months or less before an election is worth it. And even then, you have some other very strong contenders.
Krista Freeland.
Yeah, she would be, I think, a very popular choice to take over.
Yeah, you don't usually hand your party over to the person who sunk it.
Yeah.
Except in Paul Martin's case.
That's complicated, but...
that's liberal politics.
Yeah. Ultimately, I don't necessarily think the liberal base is ready to rally around her if Trudeau steps down. And I could more likely see a minister like Freeland taking over the role, who, you know, well-liked, hasn't been implicated in this yet. And I think would be able to get the votes of the membership without it being quite as contentious.
Well, I think we've killed this topic by going into wild speculation territory.
Oh, that's nothing. Like the Tai, I think, ran a why Jody Wilson-Raybould should be prime minister thing like week one of this scandal.
Of course they did.
But yeah, I think we'll wrap it up here for this. And I'm sure we'll be back next week, because at the rate this is going, you know, who knows, maybe Trudeau will have stepped down by next week. Like, this is definitely developing quickly, and we haven't heard the last of it. Moving on to quick takes. As we alluded to in the previous segment, there are concerns about accusations of treason getting thrown around at politicians. And this is particularly noteworthy because there is a protest that started in the prairies and drove its way to Ontario. And one of the signs in particular on that protest was accusing Trudeau of treason, and that got a fair bit of play.
It's actually surprising how much play this protest has gotten at all, because in the end it was 50 people. This is the United We Roll truck convoy of people angry about the federal government not supporting the oil industry enough, getting together in a convoy, driving across the country to try to, you know, stand up for jobs and pipelines. Except what ended up happening is it got either taken over or the people who were starting it turned out to all be essentially white nationalists and very anti-immigrant, very into conspiracies involving UN and globalism and other. It's too easy to call them anti-Semitic dog whistles.
I think you made the case that there were definitely dog whistles in it. Overtness maybe wasn't there in some cases, although there was a no to globalism sign, which is interestingly contrasted with the other half of that, which had a yes to pipelines and yes to tankers, which leads to this interesting question of how does one oppose globalism while wanting to sell oil to global markets?
And they also oppose buying oil from global markets, or at least the Saudi markets. Fine. Canada Land's shortcuts this week says basically all I would want to say on the coverage of this and who made up this protest. Jessie Brown had Nora Loretto on, far-left activist. She crushes it on this because she's been paying attention and saw, oh, they claimed 200 trucks were going when something like 50 or fewer ended up showing up in Ottawa. And as someone who's been at a protest with far more than 50 people that got far less attention than this, it's kind of annoying to keep hearing about convoys of angry Albertans when, don't get me wrong, Albertans are angry, but I don't know. This whole thing is annoying to me.
But I think more interestingly is who decided to join the protesters when they arrived in Ottawa. Maxime Bernier, no surprise there, but also Andrew Scheer, which, interestingly, Bernier maybe showed the better judgment in that he managed to not get in the same frame as the charge Trudeau with treason sign, where Scheer wasn't so lucky, but does indicate the space at which both of them are trying to appeal to, and it's not a great look for either of them, although it does seem very on brand for Bernier.
Well, also at said protest was failed Toronto mayoral candidate and well-documented white nationalist Faith Goldie. And anytime you're appearing on a stage with her, you gotta ask yourself, what are you doing with your life? And I think you bring up a good point that Scheer and Bernier's presence at this is, I think, the more newsworthy part than the protest itself.
Yeah, like there's the odd story in like the few days when they were driving across the country, but it kind of became a national story when two opposition leaders showed up to it.
Do we have to call Maxime Bernier an opposition leader? I guess he is as much as Elizabeth May is.
Yeah, he has a party. He's opposing the government. He's not the official leader of the opposition, but he is a leader in the opposition in his party of one.
Yeah, I wish I had some optimism out of this, but this is a start to what's going to be a very ugly 2019 election campaign.
Yes, and that ugliness also was in the Senate too, where conservative Senator David, I don't know how to pronounce it, the Katchuk? Thatchuk? Yeah, I'm not sure the proper pronunciation, but he suggested that the protesters should roll over every liberal in the country.
Cool.
Which is, you know, it's totally great we have senators endorsing violence. Now, being a senator, there's kind of no way to remove him. So, you know, that's great.
Maybe the other senators can do something about that. They did get rid of Duffy. Cool. Well, in other news that doesn't leave you feeling good inside, it came out shortly after we published last week that the Daily Telegraph in the United Kingdom has learned that Scotland Yard is investigating former BC Premier Gordon Campbell over sexual assault allegations. I guess this relates to an incident in 2013 where a former female embassy worker says she was groped by Campbell in a stairwell. She had reported it at one point, and supposedly the Canadian government investigated it, found the complaint to be without merit, but now has taken that to Metropolitan Police in London, and they're looking at it. And this would relate to when Campbell was the High Commissioner from Canada to the UK. Since then, Campbell has now, I think, stepped down from his role he was serving as reviewing Manitoba Hydro. I think he's on leave from his consultancy as well. Well, this is decided whether the allegations are with merit or not. But the thing that was most bizarre to me was the Vancouver Sun, who went and found a bunch of former Campbell colleagues to get comments that basically all just said, well, I don't think he could have done it, which in the Me Too era feel not like the most valuable contribution to the dialogue because those come up every time. Particularly Sheila Orr's comments, a former MLA with Campbell, who called him such a cold fish, I could never imagine him groping anyone. Which that might be true, and he may not have done it, but how many times do we have to hear the, well, I can't imagine him of doing that, when it turns out they did do that?
It doesn't really add anything to this, but like, part of the problem with these allegations is that it's really hard to actually provide substance when covering them, because there's usually just so little information on it that it's A, hard to come to any judgments on it until the investigation concludes, and B, what are you going to write beyond the second paragraph about it? So it's not great, these let's go out and find a bunch of people to talk to, but I kind of get why the news incentive structure leads to it. And I don't know, I don't have a great answer to how to improve the news industry right now, but I can understand why it happens. There's no great segue off of this, so we're just going to move back to Victoria, where Andrew Weaver has introduced a private member's bill to do the rather unprecedented step of applying term limits to BC legislators.
This is a repeat of a private member's bill he's introduced in the past, and it's, again, probably not going to go anywhere, because even the most successful private member's bill of the last sitting was one of his, and it made it to second reading. What this calls for, though, is that MLA's terms be capped to 12 years and the Premier 8, after which the amendment to the Elections Act of BC would basically say you would not be eligible to be a candidate in the next election. When he introduced this bill, it was met with some interruptions from across the aisle, and so Andrew Weaver called for everyone to stand up and actually vote on first reading of this. And he got his bill through with only one dissenting vote from MLA Ralph Sultan, who is the oldest MLA in the legislature, who's been there since 2001, so a good 18 years. He's not the longest serving MLA. That would go to Linda Reid, who has been there since 1991. Understandably, some of these BC Liberals who's been around a while probably would not want a term limit bill that would prevent them from running for office, but they didn't decide to stand up and defeat it on first reading.
It's not going to go anywhere, but like it's also probably very unconstitutional. And also, term limits are just a bad idea in general. Governing is a skill set, and ideally experience is a good thing, and you don't want to force a high turnover rate. And I'll point out that if the U.S. didn't have term limits, there's a good chance we'd still have President Obama rather than President Trump.
Or we'd still have President Reagan for a decade later. And then maybe it would have gone to Clinton, and maybe he'd have been president for 15, 20 years. And who knows where we'd have gone then. Once you get rid of term limits in the U.S., the rewinded history gets very complicated. That said, you look at the Senate composition of the U.S., and there's an argument for term limits. But I don't think it's term limits that cause the problem in the U.S. I agree with you on that. The other arguments you bring up, like the constitutionality, this relates to Section 3 of the Charter, which is our right to vote and stand for office. And the courts have been very broad in Section 3 when they read that. We look at the Frank v. Canada ruling that came down a few weeks ago, basically saying expat Canadians have a right to vote, period, no matter how long they've been out of the country. I can't see them ruling any differently. Like a political party could say, you can only run for us two or three times.
They would almost never do that. The power structure and incentive structure would just not.
I mean, Andrew Weaver himself has said he won't run more than three times, but...
We'll see.
Agreed. And the other element of this is even if they manage to pass this, this is one of those bills that as soon as a premier is coming up on their eighth year, you pass a law to get rid of it. It's like a balanced budget law. It won't last. Now, maybe you get cries of despotism then, but those are pretty weak in a democracy that feels as reasonably able to turn over leaders as Canada.
Yeah, I'm hard-pressed to think of a situation in Canadian history where like term limits would have been really good.
Could we have a one-term limit in Ontario just right now?
See, that's the sort of arbitrary thing that's really bad when you're trying to design a political system.
Yeah.
Because you know it would get turned around the next time. And
yeah, no. I don't expect this to go anywhere. And other than the sort of intuitive gut reaction, I don't think even many political scientists or experts otherwise support this approach. The other thing that's not being supported is Adrian Dix has said that he is not going to be mandating the measles vaccine for children. This follows a petition signed by 30,000 people calling for mandatory vaccination of children, because right now we're in the midst of a measles outbreak in Vancouver and Washington State.
Which would happen because somebody didn't vaccinate their children.
But he was afraid his child would get autism.
Yeah, so the CBC tracked down this person down and actually straight up asked him, like, well, why didn't you vaccinate your kids? And yeah, this completely unfounded fear based on a fatally flawed and study that was retracted that linked the two, even though there's absolutely no connection. And ever since then, people have been making dumb medical decisions that endanger everybody else. And the government has, in this case, declined to make a rule that would require mandatory vaccinations.
Now, I suspect part of that may be a desire to avoid what would inevitably result in a number of charter litigations, which I actually don't know what the outcome would be of such challenges. They'd be interesting, but in the meantime, people's lives are on the line. What Dix has said is he's going to look at possibly having mandatory registration of vaccination status when students start schools. He hasn't promised such a thing, but this would at least be a sort of way to get the information out there of which kids do we need to maybe ask to stay home if they're showing signs of illness. And maybe that's a way to do at least something.
It's still not great because you don't have that herd immunity, and there are people who, for legitimate medical reasons, can't be vaccinated. And, you know, they're still at those people are at risk because someone's parents were idiots and didn't vaccinate their children. I'm not sure just having a list in the principal's office is really going to address that.
All I can say is vaccinate your kids.
Yes, vaccinate your kids.
I'm British Columbia, Victoria's my capital, Canada's westmost province, touching the Pacific coast. And I have lots of mountain ranges, Whistler Mountain is
is my most famous. If you're looking to ski or snowboard, I have lots of these places.
Well, let's finish off. Do we want to bring back Best of BC Poly? I'm saying it's by popular demand. I have had DM asking for us to discuss this. And because this tweet was mentioned in the Slack, I thought we could at least mention it here. So one Premier John Horgan tweets out recently, thanks for the follow at the Kate Mulgrew. For the record, Captain Janeway is the best hashtag Star Trek captain ever. Live long and prosper emoji, hashtag Voyager.
And to which Kate Mulgrew replies, carry on, Premier Horgan. Your excellent taste is a clear indicator that you enjoy a prosperous career in Starfleet. Same emoji sign, Canadian flag emoji.
Our invitation for Premier Horgan to come on and debate you on DS9 versus Voyager is always open. Just get in touch with us.
For the record, Picard's the best captain.
I'm liking the new Captain Pike, actually.
A little behind my Discovery.
It's pretty good. Season 2, get on it.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Sergei Plotnikov. Thanks for listening.